The College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandi.
And welcome to the College Football Podcast. It is a Wednesday. David Pollock, Kevin Nagandi with you. Plenty of good stuff coming your way. Paul Feinbaum's going to join us. We're going to get his thoughts about the SEC situation when it comes to Alabama, Florida, as well as the battle for the Heisman featuring three names from the SEC. And then we're going to take a look at the coaching situation in that conference with some of the openings. Andrea Adelson will join us as well to get us ready for the ACC rematch. I think the best game on the schedule, despite the line that features Clemson and Notre Dame. And then Tom Luganville will join us because in the middle of all of this, in the middle of preparation for the playoff and the conference championship games and what we'll see of a bowl season, today is signing day. So he'll give us an update on who are the winners and who are the surprises, and right now who is struggling at this moment in the middle of a pandemic trying to recruit players. I will say one thing about the recruiting process. Transfer portal, that will be maybe the biggest story this entire offseason. We'll pick Luke's brain about that. But let's first start, Pollock, about what we saw last night. I think, like all of us, we're trying to figure out what makes sense, what is applied, and what isn't applied, because if we follow a certain format and then you use that same format for another group of teams, it doesn't make sense. At the top, I think there's no surprises. I think it just gets murky potentially on that battle for the fourth spot if we were to see an upset, and that is Notre Dame beating Clemson, because then it's a scramble, and then you've got A&M at 5, you've got Iowa State at 6, you've got poor Cincinnati, who hasn't played since the third week of November, saying, "Wait, we're losing spots now. We're 9." You've got Oklahoma. How do you make sense of all of this as we try to dig deeper and get a better understanding of the thought process?
First of all, you can't make sense, and neither can Gary Barta, when you're speaking for 13 people. You're not just speaking for yourself. I do love the fact that he has to answer Iowa State questions all the time, though. That's kind of funny, being the Iowa
AD. By the way,
he's the Iowa AD, so it's just – it's interesting to listen to those. And by the way, he's not even in the room for those discussions because he has to, he has to leave. But I think it's impossible. I don't think it's an easy task. It's not envious. If you took 12 of or 13 of ESPN's analysts and you sat them in a room and you had this debate, it would be different as well. All of us would like different things. All of us would find different teams maybe more appealing than others. It's just human nature. It's the way it goes. It's impossible to get it the way everybody wants to see it. This year, with all the clutter, with the lack of out of conference, Kevin, and it's even harder. And this is why I would have loved to see us expand it. But I just don't get it. I'm not seeing I usually have a pretty good pulse. I'm like, dude, all right, they beat so-and-so, because of their two wins, they're where they're at, okay. They had a bad loss, but because of what they've done on the field, they're here. Every time I point to somebody that's done something on the field, I can also point to somebody else that's done something on the field that doesn't get the credit for it. And, listen, this isn't a surprise, by the way. This is a Power 5 playoff. It is. Okay. If you're just new to the party, welcome to the party. Like, thanks for your anger, but this has been the case for years and will continue to be the case, which is why we should have a Power 5 playoff. It would be amazing. It would be unfreaking believable to watch every year, to highlight those programs that are daggum ballers, that play the game awesome. Like, it would be fun. But it's a system that no system is perfect. But this year, I think with less comparisons, less at a conference, I think it looks even more it's even more frustrating as a fan.
You mentioned Power 5. Even the best teams from the group of 5, like, what do you make – how do you make sense of Coastal Carolina being 3 back of Cincinnati and still outside the top 10 after beating Louisiana, one in the country, after beating a pretty darn good App State team, and then beating BYU? Like, it feels like Coastal, you can make a case, is better than Cincinnati when you look at who they have beaten.
Here's the problem with people. Kevin, everybody who watches college football, once you get an opinion, it's really hard to shift. It's really hard to change. I thought Cincinnati was the best Group of Five team. I pointed to that. I looked at them. I respected the mess out of them. I'm going to tell you something. What Coastal Carolina has done, by the way, and played 11 games and beat BYU, which is a better win than Cincinnati. Like you talked about, App State was a really good win. Louisiana's a top 17 team, I think, right? I mean, like, what have they not done that UC has done? They've been uber impressive. And I think people here's what happens. We point to things and we pick at things and they don't do this. I don't think Coastal Carolina's defense is as elite as Cincinnati, but I think their offense is a daggum problem. And I think their offense can spell their defense and keep their defense fresh and keep their defense off the field because of the way they run their offense that we've already covered at nauseam on this podcast, because I might as well be a Teal Nation and fan club, especially with Jamie Chadwell and his offense. So I think if I'm looking at body of work, if I'm looking at they've won more games, played more games, got more data points, have two more impressive wins, why are the Chanticleers not ahead of Cincinnati? I don't know the answer to that question.
It's a big deal, too, when you talk about what's at stake money-wise and getting an automatic bid, the highest Group of Five team getting the chance to play in a New Year's Six game. So there's a lot at stake for both these schools when it comes to the finances. I mean, we've got to be blunt about it. I heard somebody say, on Twitter after the release last night, hey, Cincinnati and Coastal should just basically tell the committee, hey, screw off. We're going to just play each other and we're not going to have a bowl game. And I was like, that's fantastic. But there's finances involved here. There's money involved. And the
opportunity, I don't want
your six games,
$6 million. I'm good. Like I'm hard pass. let's do that in life. You know what? Let's go. This would be a great matchup if I went to get head to head with this other company. I'm not going to make any money, but let's just go have some fun. And that $6 million, like, yeah, it's okay. pass.
Okay. There again, the biggest topic yesterday we talked about on SportsCenter, and yeah, it was a huge discussion on the show with you guys, with Reese in the top 25, was the hypotheticals of what if Notre Dame beats Clemson? Clemson's out with two losses. And who's there fighting for that fourth spot? And you brought up a great point. It felt like everybody was talking about Iowa State, the idea that Florida's still in it because they only dropped one spot, which was a huge shock. But you brought up a great point. Texas A&M sitting there at five, and no one's – they felt like a placeholder for a long time, and that placeholder is suddenly a valuable position at five here entering this weekend.
Dude, it happened on game day. And it happened on the show. Like, literally, we're sitting there talking, and it's almost like, it's literally like you're talking about somebody, or like you're talking about a situation where everybody's involved and you got all these people in a room and there's this one person in the corner, but like, we just don't mention that person. No, they don't have a say. We didn't even mention them. I mean, it was kind of nuts. Like, they did beat Florida, who obviously is ranked really high. They're a good football team. Florida's a really good football team. They lost to LSU. Yeah, they're out of the conversation for playoffs in my eyes. Yes, but they're still really, really good. So A&M, I think their defense has come a long way. I think they've early in the season, they had tough challenges too, playing Alabama, playing some of those teams early on. I think their offense found their identity in the Florida game, and they're a smash mouth, hit you in the mouth. Kellen Mond can play action, use his feet, run. They've got some matchups that are favorable for them, where they can do with their multiple running backs and basically wide receivers. So I think that A&M's a really good football team. They deserve to be talked about at least. I got a little frustrated I was checking my screen a couple of times to make sure that I saw it right. Like, I have returned now finally, because we're doing satellite, and I still feel like I was back in the day of quarantine when I didn't even have return and I couldn't see that A&M was ranked fifth. I couldn't see them on my screen. I felt like they had disappeared or something.
But here's one thing though. And I don't think the committee wants this. I don't know outside of anybody at College Station wants this concept of A&M getting in as the four seed and a rematch of Alabama, considering they've already faced off against each other and it wasn't a close game. Could you stomach that? Could you stomach one versus four, A&M versus Alabama?
Here's the thing. I understand that. And, by the way, I don't think A&M is going to beat them. But I don't think anybody's going to beat them in the four hole. So it really doesn't matter to me. But if A&M has earned the right to be there and they're one of the four best teams, I don't give a dang about what the heck happened during the season. It doesn't matter to me. We can't do that to A&M and say, they lost to them. I got them at four. But, you know, I'm going to bump the next team ahead of them. Mm-hmm. I don't feel that way. I think if you're the fourth best team in the country, I don't care what the matchup is. Go win. Go play. Like, whoever is at the four spot is in a not a worthy situation.
But let's do the eye test with you, David Pollack, not the committee. Would you put a two-loss Clemson team above Texas A&M eye test-wise?
No.
Would you put a two-loss Iowa State or two-loss Oklahoma team ahead of Texas?
That real quick. The eye test is hugely important. Yeah. It is hugely important. The eye test goes a long way. But the resume also counts. Like, I know Florida's better than LSU, but Florida just lost to LSU. I don't give a crap. Like, you can't just say, yes, I watched them in this prism, and they're better. Like, they are better. But what have you accomplished? Let's talk realistically real quick, Kevin. Who the hell has Clemson beat?
Like, but David, I can do the same thing with Texas A&M, and that one thing that benefits Texas A&M last night was not what they did on the field. It's what the committee did to Florida, right? Just dropping them one spot actually helped Texas A&M in any conversation. But if you take Alabama's 10-0 record out and you look at the wins and the resume that A&M has, it's not great. You know, a 9 Vandy team, you beat a struggling Mississippi State team, Arkansas, South Carolina, who's getting a new coach. You beat LSU. Okay, granted, LSU saved their season, at least the storyline and the narrative last week. But
no, LSU
were coming in 3-5. Auburn just got rid of their coach. Like, so when you bring resumes to the table, it's very hard. And now, granted, everybody's going to be like, strength of schedule when you look at A&M. But strength of schedule is helped by Alabama going 10-0, and they lost to Alabama by 28 points.
Yeah. Here's the thing, though. But again, now you're putting Clemson in a different box. You're putting Clemson in a box of they have two losses. So
yes.
I have to treat them as a two-loss team. I can say that I might think they're a little better than A&M, but I have to take away points, and I have to say they lost another game. They've lost two games. They played Notre Dame twice and got beat twice. If we're doing this,
one of them was in overtime. One of them also didn't feature Trevor Lawrence and some key defensive players. I'm not making excuses. I'm just saying I'm just putting everything out there on the table when you're talking about the eye test. And is Clemson better? Or, you know, hey, what about Oklahoma, right? And the way they've been playing. We talked about this on the podcast on how well they've been playing of late. What about Iowa State and the wins that they have? Right.
There's absolutely no way to do this and be right.
You're right.
Like, there's no way to anything you say, I can make an argument, and it's my opinion regardless. So everybody, that's why we've got so many diverse opinions of football studied people that have been around the game for a long time to come together and try to do the best they can do. But you can't tell me there isn't a perfect system. You can knock the system all you want. Hell, it ain't the BCS, thank God. Mm-hmm. Like, thank you, Jesus. We don't have that anymore. But I just think that I can poke holes in everybody. I can make everybody look worse. I can make some teams look better. But to me, at the end of the day, Kevin, I would love for you to have a couple quality wins on your resume. I would love to see you play a couple good teams and beat them. Not I played one or two good teams and I lost to them. To my eyes, to my view and how I would judge it, that would mean more than anything else, than the record of the teams I played. Like, did I beat a couple really good teams? Did I show up consistently? Do I have an offense that can score points? Because I've got to score points if I'm going to be in the top four. Like, if I'm going to win a game, I got to show up with that side of the football.
And by the way, before everybody gets upset and at Texas A&M. Just understand, we are playing scenarios out here because you can never count out the idea of a team jumping up in front of them. I mean, just specifically ask Baylor and TCU, right? And yep. So these are the debates I'm sure that are going to be heavily discussed heading into, you know, Sunday if we do have an upset in the ACC championship game. So just be prepared because everybody's going to make their case. But the best thing for Texas A&M last night, again, was the idea that Florida dropped only one spot. And with Florida at 7, if Florida were to beat Alabama, could you see Florida? Because when you look at all the teams, Florida will have the best win in the country when it comes to resume. Could you see Florida back into the conversation inside the top four if they beat Alabama?
And two top eight wins, you know, when you look at the
Georgia
and you say Bama and Georgia, I mean, that would be an impressive resume. I don't see it. I feel like the LSU loss is an albatross. I feel like that's going to weigh them down because LSU's been so poor this season. But man, it would be crazy. I think Alabama's still in regardless. I think Notre Dame and Alabama are in the best situations. Those are the seats you want to be in on this weekend.
100%. And listen, if everything goes chalk, Bama wins, Clemson wins, Ohio State wins, the top four will still be the top four. They may be just refigured differently, you know, I would anticipate Notre Dame would be four and we'd have Alabama, Notre Dame in the Sugar Bowl. And then Clemson versus Ohio State, a rematch of one of the best games I've seen in a long time, that Fiesta from a year ago, and the rematch with Fields and Lawrence. And potentially that would be the Rose Bowl. Fingers crossed that it is at the Rose Bowl. We'll see how that plays out in the coming weeks.
And you know what? Do they make sure that they don't do Bama or Clemson and Notre Dame again? Or
You can't have Clemson and Notre Dame again. You can't.
I get you, but if it's two, if they're 2-3, you should. Like, I don't care what you can't have. Like,
no. But
teams in the best order.
Here's the thing: if Clemson is 3, they beat Notre Dame. They deserve to be number 2. Ohio State wins. They finish undefeated at 6-0. They move up one spot. Notre Dame just drops 2 spots.
A 10-1 Notre Dame that lost by 6 to Clemson isn't ahead of an Ohio State team that's 6-0.
There's no way. I
hear what you're saying, but Notre Dame would clearly, to me, to be more deserving of the number 3 spot than Ohio State.
I get that, but this is a subjective, you know, the idea of, all right, we've already seen that. Let's have something different.
I don't care if I've seen it. I want the best teams ranked in the order they are rewarded for what they are.
Well, I do too. But there's a lot of things that we've talked about in the first 20 minutes of this podcast where we're not seeing the best teams ranked where they're supposed to be ranked.
Those other ones are negotiable. Those other ones are hard. 1 and 2 aren't negotiable right now. Like 1 and 2 are clearly defined.
100%.
So if Notre Dame loses a really close game to Clemson, that clearly they were the number 2 team in the country, they lose to the number 2 team in the country, you could make a case that they are still the number 3 team in the country.
You can make the case, but I just don't think that's going to happen. That's what I'm saying. You can make the case. I just don't think it's – and if it were to happen, I would come on this podcast with you, and the first thing I would say is, David Pollack, you're right.
I feel like you've had to do that before.
That'd be the toughest thing for me to do, and I would actually mean it, okay? All right, listen, good stuff because we covered a lot of layers to what happened last night and getting ready for, of course, Saturday and Sunday. Let's get your due to the week.
All right, you ready for this?
Let's go.
If you haven't been watching Pac-12 football, and if you watched USC last week and you watched the scoreboard, and you go, man, they're not very good defensively. They gave up a lot of points. If you didn't watch number 15, you're missing out on a treat. All right, you ready? I'm going to see if I can get this name right. Talanoa Hufanga. Is that right?
Hufanga. Yep. You got it, man. You nailed it.
Talanoa Hufanga. Dude, he number 15 is a absolute missile. I love watching him play. He had 17 tackles last week, 2 tackles for a loss, a forced fumble, and an INT. And by the way, he doesn't like people. I love this dude. He comes up low pad level. He plays near the line of scrimmage. He had a pick 6 a week ago before the UCLA game. He's an absolute stud animal. If you're watching the Pac-12 and you don't like defense, first of all, we gave you Nate Landman last week, who's an animal. and then unfortunately got hurt last week too, by the way. But now Talanoa Hufanga is an absolute beast. Number 15 for USC. He's the dude of the week.
All right, Matt. And USC, of course, 13th in the country. We'll see them Friday night taking on Oregon in the Pac-12 championship game. I think if you said that at the beginning of the season, everybody would be like, okay, the big surprise is that USC's in it. No, it's actually the big surprise is Oregon, because what Washington's dealing with when it comes to COVID. So at least I think we get a marquee game Friday night for that conference, prime time. They get the showcase. And the country, if you have not watched USC, just understand that Keaton Slovis will sling it again. Exactly. And this team, if they're down by a score in the final 2 minutes, do not get up and walk away, because USC
played three times now. Interesting.
They've been a lot of fun to watch. I thought that UCLA game was really a lot of fun. And props to Chip, because he leaps and bounds. That team looks completely different than what it did when he took over in that first year. All right, ready for our games here? Because I think that when it comes to games, oh, man, especially spreads, not that good. Taylor, can you give us an update on where we are in the win column and the gap?
So it's a gap of 5 points right now. I'm struggling to pull up the actual...
That's okay.
I'm with
it. It's over. We know it's over.
Let's double down here.
So last week, David, you went 6-1. Kevin, you went 5-2. You guys had both a net of +5. Kevin, you hit the upset special with North Carolina. That gets you an extra 2 points. So Kevin or David is up 23 right now. 23-17 is how we're running it at the
18,
moment.
Right. That would be five.
Yes. So.
Yeah. Right.
Carry the one. Yeah, it's okay.
Oh, boy. So, you guys, Matt is not my strong suit. I'm a podcast
slowly
producer.
But surely, I'm making my way. I'm making my way back to you, man. Just slowly.
I'll give you props. You've done a good job, man, because you were struggle busting it early.
I dug a hole. Let's just say that. Yeah. I'm slowly coming up for air. All right. So do we even want to deal with the spreads that are in double digits, or do we want to just talk about the tight games?
Let's just do tight games.
Tight games. All right, let's start with Oregon, USC. USC laying 3. Who you got?
Oh, gosh. I'll take... Wow. I'll take the Ducks.
You're taking the Ducks straight up?
I'll take the Ducks. I'll take the Ducks. USC's glass slipper falls off, and they don't find a way to win in the fourth quarter.
This is going to be fun. I will gladly take USC. All right, let's move on. This is an interesting game. Oklahoma laying 5 versus Iowa State. And I say this every week to our audience. We just do pick'ems. I just like to talk about the spreads in the closest games so you have some context. So Oklahoma laying 5 versus Iowa State. If we're doing a pick'em, I'm going with the Sooners.
I'm going with the Sooners too. I've been impressed with their defense and just, man – Iowa State's awesome, and they're healthy. They're finally healthy again, and offensive line's good, better than it was, healthier than it was, and they're toting the rock. But just the explosiveness, can they match the explosiveness of Oklahoma? I don't think they can. I think it's going to be a great game, but I'll take Oklahoma.
This is a really cool matchup. Louisiana versus Coastal Carolina. Carolina is laying 3.5.
Coastal. You know I'm going Coastal. Like, I just – so impressed. By the way, last time they played, I do believe it was, I think Coastal kicked a field goal at the end. Like, it
three
was
point
a really
game.
Good game. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it was really, really good. But I just, Grayson McCall is fabulous. He's McClutch. He's the man. I think their offense and their ball control offense is good. I love everything they're doing.
I'm with you. I was hoping you were going to go the other way. So I will pick Coastal. And that game's in Brooks Stadium, Conway, South Carolina, and that team has some magic going on. I think it's going to continue. Okay, this is an interesting game. Boise State laying 6.5 versus San Jose State, Mountain West Championship.
Who you got?
I'm going with San Jose State, and that's going to be my upset special.
I'm with you. Nick Starkel. Remember, he was a big-time recruit. By the way, San Jose State and what they've dealt with all year long.
Incredible.
It's been cool to watch. Last week, again, get down and all of a sudden, you know, hit the gas and special teams with a kick return. And I think they're good, but Starkel makes them really good. He's very efficient at the QB spot. So I'll take the better QB play, which you usually don't say, by the way, because Boise usually has a QB they can depend on, but I'll take Starkel.
Okay. So we're on the same page there. Let's get two more games on the board here. And let's start with Air Force Army. Air Force laying 2.5. Air Force has only played 5 games. Army coming off that emotional win against Navy.
I'm taking Army. I like Big Buchanan, their big wrecking ball that is the fullback. He's 260 pounds. He's freaking awesome. I love that cat. So I'll take Army.
Here's the thing, Pollock. That was an emotional win, like an emotional victory for Army.
It was a butt kicking, by the way.
And usually they don't have a game after that, right? They go to a bowl game. Yep. And so you just got to wonder. But the one thing that benefits them is that it's going to be at West Point. So I will also pick Army. Our final one.
Way to go out on a limb when you're down 5, by the way. That's a great decision.
You're not going to trash talk me. We've got bowl season. All right, on the final game, I just got it circled because I think it's going to be fun. Ole Miss at LSU, Ole Miss favored by 2.5.
Ole Miss is favored?
By 2.5 in Baton Rouge.
A lot has changed in a year. Good Lord.
Crazy, right?
I'll take Ole Miss.
Son of a gun, I was going to take Ole Miss too.
I think both of us feel the reason why is when you watch LSU's defense and now you bring in that offense that can score. Now, listen, LSU's offense is going to look fabulous this week. I mean, they're going to look amazing, but I think Ole Miss can hit 40.
Yeah, I'm with you. And we'll do one more just to please our boy, Taylor. Michigan State at Maryland. Maryland favored by 2.5. And another reason why we're doing is if there's games that are canceled by COVID, we just kind of have a little bit more options. So Michigan State at Maryland and Maryland favored by 2.5. I'm actually going to take the Terps.
I'm taking the Terps too. Don't fake the funk on a nasty dunk, man. Give me some funk running the football, you know, and I don't think Maryland's offense is where it needs to be. And I don't think Tagovailoa is playing as good as he should, because he should be better more consistently. But I think that there it's light years better than Michigan State. I mean, Michigan State's offense.
Okay. So with that, my upset special, San Jose State, you can't take the same team. So who you got?
I know. I tried to take North Carolina last week. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That one.
Mm-hmm.
I got to look now. Hold on.
You've taken only favorites aside from San Jose State.
I don't think you're right when you make that smarmy comment you just made.
Oh, you know what? You took Oregon. And they're getting 3.
So I'll accept your apology for being wrong. Thank you. Let's see. We can cut all this out. That's the beautiful thing.
No, we'll keep it in because you like to give me a shut up paired.
Taylor, you're going to love this. I'm thinking about – I think y'all X-nayed this. Can I go to Louisiana?
See, that is actually that is a smart move. Go with Louisiana. Yes, go. Go with Louisiana. Yeah, you're hedging your bets.
I love the Shaunts, though. I can't do that. I'll just take Oregon. I'll stick with Oregon.
All right.
I'll double down on Oregon.
All right, brother. Well, listen, let's just hope. I think in Charlotte we're going to have a great game. Let's hope it lives up to the buildup coming into it in the ACC championship. And be well, my man.
I did. See y'all.
You know, I saved him for the last few weeks for this week because I thought, you know, there's two major topics that we could discuss. And, of course, that would be the SEC championship game and the Heisman race. And then when you throw in the coaching moves in a pandemic and the openings that we currently have, he's the perfect guest to have right now, and that is Paul Feinbaum joining us here on the College Football Podcast. And Paul, let's begin here with, a week ago was this buildup of Florida Alabama after the Gators lost in the fog game or the shoe game, depending on
how you feel about it. After losing to LSU, the one thing that stood out on Tuesday night with the rankings is the committee just dropped them one spot. And suddenly you're like, uh-oh. And I mentioned this to Pollock. That one spot dropping them down still keeps Florida potentially in their hopes alive, as well as helping Texas A&M boost their resume right now at 5. So with that in mind, as we get ready for a game like this, does Florida have any chance against the Bama team that has just been dominant week in and week out?
Kevin, a sage once told me never, ever answer a question by saying a team has no chance. However, I will make an exception here. I don't believe Florida has any chance against Alabama. I mean, I'm not going to waste your time with all these equivocations of, oh, yeah, you know, blah, 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 anything can happen. But I don't see it. I think they're really a good team that has, that seemingly is going the wrong way. And I know everyone's saying, oh, yeah, well, now Dan Mullen has their attention. Really? At this point in the season, it takes a clunker against LSU, which is, you know, let's be honest, a mediocre team at best, to get your attention. I don't see it. I think you need to be playing well at this point in the year. And short of Alabama opting out of the game, not being able to make the trip to Atlanta, Alabama is going to win the SEC championship.
In a season where we've seen flaws with many, many quality high programs where you have questions and doubts, I'm stunned that each week when we watch Alabama, they check every single box. Like, granted that, you know, the story hasn't been completely told. We have yet to see how they play this weekend as well as, you know, the playoff. But where would you put this team when it comes to the conversation of all-time great ones under Saban? Because right now, their most underrated aspect is the defense. And their defense is fantastic, but no one talks about it because they keep on scoring points.
Yeah, it looks like his best team. On January 12th, if Alabama has won the national championship in the same fashion as they've won every other game this year, I think I'd probably go that far. And I would also say if Alabama ends up winning, Kevin, they didn't win it on January 11th. They may have won this thing back in March. I'll never forget hearing from friends on that Alabama program that the day that the world stopped, that everything started getting shut down in March, Nick Saban was ready to have spring practice that day. And he was like, are you telling me we can't practice? And he immediately figured out a way to get everybody Apple Watches and started monitoring everything they did when they went home and never let up and never gave an inch. And, you know, it was you know, a bumpy road at times, you know, with him personally and many of his team. But he never lost the edge. You know, Kirby, I remember interviewing Kirby Smart at home with, you know, kids in the background and Jeremy Pruitt with a baby crib in behind him. Nick Saban never left his office. I mean, I don't know. You know, I mean, when everything was closed in Alabama, Nick Saban was still in his office, war gaming, scheming, planning. And that is one reason why when things finally, you know, got back to at least a modicum of normalcy in June and July when players came back, he was ready. He never missed a day.
He's a creature of habit, and when he did have to at least miss being there, we saw Sark take over, and again, they don't miss a beat. Jaylen Waddle, done for the season, they don't miss a beat. And that transitions into the conversation that go figure in the year of the quarterback with an award that has been dominated by quarterbacks. The turn that we are seeing with Devontae Smith now leading the Heisman watch heading into the weekend. How do you think this potentially plays out after Mac Jones, the team scores 50 plus points, has no touchdowns. Kyle Trask struggles in the first half with 3 turnovers against LSU. I mean, his numbers were impressive on the back end, 474 and doing everything he can to make it a good game. But like, how does this play out on Saturday in your mind with these two quarterbacks, Devontae, and then, you know, you got the Trevor Lawrence lurking right there and Ian Book lurking right there in their game in the ACC championship?
Yeah, I mean, I think Kyle Trask certainly is in trouble, and he was leading going into that game. Now, I don't know how to figure this thing out as a Heisman voter, Kevin. You know, exactly where do you go? Do you go chalk with Mac Jones? Do you go Devontae? And you're right. I mean, when Waddle went down, a lot of our colleagues, including the guy you just spoke to, wrote Alabama off. And I understand. I mean, he was the most impactful, exciting, exhilarating player in the country. And, you know, maybe he'll matter in a semifinal game or, you know, late in the fourth quarter of the national championship. But it hasn't shown up yet. And all it's really done is give Devontae the edge in terms of momentum. I think you just have to watch this game and figure it out. And I also think you made a great point. You know, Ian Book has been overlooked, of course. Trevor Lawrence is the one who I think really has been overshadowed. And I want to see, you know, I want to see what he does. And, you know, he has the advantage of playing first. I mean, if he lights it up and then the Alabama game is a little hard to decipher, you know, it's a, you know, maybe they win, but nobody really stands out. Maybe Najee Harris steals the show. Then I can see some votes gravitating. I mean, this is one time when a lot of the old codgers, you know, that you can't vote a week or two ahead of time. I mean, back in the day, you'd get your ballot and these, you know, and I'm not trying to act like I'm a teenager, Kevin, please. But, you know, these 75, 85-year-old former sports writers who cling to their ballot, they would just go ahead and run to the mailbox and get it in so they didn't lose their vote. Well, now that it's online, I mean, there's no excuse to vote before Sunday morning. So I think that favors, you know, whoever has the hot hand on Saturday.
Absolutely agree. If you voted already, and I'm sorry, I have a ton of doubt because you need to see what happens on the biggest stage against better competition. That's what we're going to see this weekend when talking about five men. And Justin Fields is on the outside, unfortunately, just not enough games. The one thing that's working against a Devontae Smith as well as a Mac Jones, and you could even make the case of Najee Harris, they can also potentially cancel each other out, right? And that in a process could separate a guy like Trevor Lawrence or Ian Book. If they have outstanding games in the 4 o'clock window. Okay. So I think a lot of people in the pandemic assumed that with money being tight, finances everywhere and layoffs and furloughs and hiring freezes, that we wouldn't see a lot of movement when it comes to coaches, and leave it to the SEC to say, you know what? We've got $21 million. We've got enough for a buyout. It's time to go, Gus. What does that do? This opening at Auburn and what we saw at South Carolina, and potentially, you know, Vandy just filled their job, but maybe a possibility at Tennessee, and Hugh Freeze's success at Liberty. What does this move by Alabama mean? And when we talk about the options, the Napiers, the Cristobals, the Sarks of the world, as well as Hugh Freeze, what does that mean for the Auburn job?
Well, yeah, again, if you've ever lived in Alabama, visited Auburn, you shouldn't be surprised. This is Auburn. They don't care what you think or I think, and they have been gunning for Gus Malzahn for years. So it was inevitable. It just came a little bit soon for some people's taste. The coaching search is interesting because the under the radar favorite is the guy down the hall, Kevin Steele. And I'm sure people around the country are going, well, who did he say? I mean, Kevin Steele, who is he? He was once the coach at Baylor and a terrible coach he was. And he was fired there and, you know, he picked himself up and, you know, spent some time in the NFL. He ultimately went to Florida State and he was the first hire by Nick Saban in 2007, not so much for his defense, but because of his recruiting. He was that good, and he was Saban's first defensive coordinator, and then Kirby Smart ascended, and Kevin saw the handwriting on the wall. He ended up at Clemson, got run there too, rehabilitated, got back to Alabama, ultimately went to LSU, then took over at Auburn. That's a long journey back, but he's made a lot of friends, and at Auburn, making friends in high places a little bit the antithesis of Garth Brooks's hit song is what you need to do. And I think right now, and this could change by the end of the week, he's the inside favorite. I don't see Hugh Freeze getting that job. Napier is interesting. The most fascinating name I've heard all week was Mario Cristobal, but you know, is that someone just, you know, playing one against the other and trying to get a new deal at Oregon? Probably. That's how this industry works. But Auburn is, you know, I mean, 21, and by the way, Kevin, 21 million, that just covers Gus Malzahn. Mm-hmm. That doesn't cover his staff. I mean, this thing, I'm told from insiders, could go over 30. Wow. If they go outside. Now, if Kevin Steele gets it, it will be bargain basement, because he's already there. They don't have to pay moving expenses or buyouts for the staff.
Okay, that's fascinating. We'll keep an eye on that. And obviously the news of Tom Herman staying at least for one more year. Who knows what we'll see from your best friend up north, and that is Jim Harbaugh in Michigan's future. You know, Paul, listen, for our audience, if you love college football, I'm sure this is nothing new to you, but I think you have the best radio show when it comes to college football information from 3 to 7 daily, Paul Feinbaum show. You can check it out on ESPN News, also Sirius XM 81. And I'm setting you up this way because you talk to so many people in the industry on your show. And I'm not saying that you have an answer, but as of December 16th, who do you think will be, well, I should say, which program will have Hugh Freeze as their head coach next season?
I think the one that is the most interesting is Tennessee. And I say that because Tennessee fans realize they may have to encounter Jeremy Pruitt for another year, because Philip Fulmer, the athletic director, gave him a contract extension before the season. I don't know why. I've yet to hear an explanation. But, you know, when you're Philip Fulmer, you can do whatever you want. I think that's a possibility, but he'll get a job next year if somehow he doesn't get one this year. You have to kind of, you know, bite your tongue when you hire Hugh Freeze, but what you get is one of the better offensive innovative minds in the country. Yeah, I mean, it's cliche to say he beat Nick Saban 2 years in a row, but do you know anyone else who has done that since Les Miles left LSU? About, you know, he did that back in 2010 and 11, but nobody's done that other than Hugh Freeze. That should qualify you for a lot of jobs. And it's interesting that Hugh Freeze told me once, sitting in his office in Oxford, that on his honeymoon, he got married in East Tennessee, and he and his wife were driving through Knoxville. They went up to the top of the hill there, peered into Neyland Stadium with the Smoky Mountains in the background, and said, man, if I could ever get the head coaching job here later in life, that would be my dream job. And he wants the job there. So that's where I land.
Does Greg Sankey want him back in the conference?
I would say no.
that is a big question, right? That needs to be answered by any school in the SEC when talking about Hugh Freeze, right?
Yeah, and Sankey told me once that he didn't block Hugh Freeze from getting a job in the SEC. Saban wanted to hire him as the offensive coordinator a couple of years ago, and so did pretty much everyone else. The reason why Sankey was reluctant is that Ole Miss at the time was still on probation from a bowl ban because of, guess who? Hugh Freeze's regime. So the feeling was it was fair to keep him out. I don't think Sankey per se would say, you're not coming in. He would maybe put him on double secret probation, like they did with Bruce Pearl a couple of years ago. Now, Bruce Pearl got past that by going to the Final Four. And even though his program may be under investigation, if you go to the Final Four at Auburn, you pretty much are there for life. So I think Hugh Freeze could get back in the league, but every year that goes by is 1 year further removed from his exit at Ole Miss, which was about as ugly as it gets.
We will see how that plays out, of course, in the offseason. Listen, you're always great. And again, I can't say enough kind words about what you do on that show on a daily basis from 3 to 7 p.m. on the East Coast. Paul Feinbaum Show on Sirius XM 81, as well as ESPN News. Be well, my friend.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Really appreciate it. Always great.
And it's great to have Andrea Adelson, college football reporter, joining us. Her focus has always been on the ACC, as we've had her on the podcast to break things down. And
I've hyped this game up. I will hype it the rest of the week, whether it's on a podcast, whether it's on SportsCenter, whether it's on social media. To me, it is a pivotal game and critical game because so much will be at stake. Clemson, Notre Dame. And when I say so much, if we see some chaos, it'll be coming from a game like this. And that would mean the conversation of multiple teams lining up for that fourth and final playoff spot. Let's begin here on the line. Andrea, you know, Notre Dame beat Clemson the first time. And I'm fully aware, as everybody else was, that Trevor Lawrence did not play that game. And the defense was beat up. But the line is at 10.5. And when I saw that, I was like, whoa, I didn't expect that. Your response to a line like that and Clemson getting the chance for a rematch, a rare rematch in the regular season coming off a loss?
First of all, the fact that we are sitting here hyping up the ACC championship game is progress in itself. So let's just start with that, because that probably has never happened in the history of the ACC championship game. But I'm with you. Anybody who thinks that this is going to be a slam dunk Clemson win did not watch the game in November. And I know that Trevor was out. I know there were key defensive players out, but there's one thing that stood out to me in that game. And it was the sheer physicality that Notre Dame played with, both on the offensive line and the defensive line, that overwhelmed Clemson, that Clemson simply did not have an answer for. Clemson has struggled to run the ball consistently in the latter half of the season. If you look at Travis Etienne and his numbers, he's actually been more productive in the passing game out of the backfield. So Clemson has to solve that issue. Yeah, Trevor is back. That's great. They hope James Skalski will be at 100%, their terrific linebacker who did not play the first time around. Tyler Davis on the interior of that defensive line should be back, and he should help. But if Clemson cannot fix this issue, it's going to be a long day for Clemson. So I also was surprised the line was at 10.5. I think Notre Dame is not getting nearly enough credit for the season that it has put together up until this point. And Clemson, because Trevor is back, automatically people think, well, yeah, of course, Clemson. I'm not so sure about that. And so to me, the spotlight is not going to be on Trevor Lawrence. It's going to be on Clemson's offensive and defensive lines to see if they can play better than they did in November.
How is Notre Dame handling this? You know, they don't need motivation, but I'm sure Brian Kelly was like, okay, great. I don't need to say anything else to my team as everybody continues to doubt us despite what we've done this season.
The motivation for Notre Dame is to win an ACC championship because it's something they have never, ever done before. And it'll probably be either a long time and or never again for a situation to unfold like this for the Irish. We all know how much they value their independence. And everything that Brian Kelly has said, that their athletic director, Jack Swarbrick, has said, points to the fact that when this is all over, they're going back to being an independent. So this is the moment for them to be able to capture a conference championship for the first time in school history. And Brian Kelly has been talking about this now for weeks, that this was the goal that the players targeted as soon as they found out that they were going to be playing in the ACC this year and that the football season was going to proceed. I think the fact that they won the game in November certainly gives them confidence going to this game, but they also realize that this is going to be a different Clemson team with Trevor, who I think will be able to help the Clemson run game because of what he can do as both a runner and a passer. They didn't really have that with DJ Uiagalelei. He can run, but he was also injured in that game. And so he wasn't used in the run game the way that they have been able to use Trevor. So that to me is going to be a key difference for Notre Dame going into this game is, okay, you know, they struggled a little bit up front, couldn't really get the run game going. They're going to try and get the run game going now by using Trevor Lawrence in it. So how do you account for that? How do you answer that? They're all aware of that. Brian Kelly has talked about it. The players have talked about it. But I do feel like they have got a confidence going into this game, knowing that they already beat Clemson once. So who's saying they can't do it again?
Yeah, it feels like, you know, the tone setter in that first game was Kyren Williams' big run in the beginning, because it changed the entire, I think it gave Notre Dame breathing room, but it changed the entire approach, right? Hey, we have the deep home run threat in Kyren Williams. Ian Book, he was fantastic in that game. And since then, he's been brilliant. One of the things that has really stood out, and I want to get your thoughts on it, is Javon McKinley's growth, Mayer's growth, the comfort that he has, Skowronek's growth, the comfort that Ian Book has had in the last month and a half after that win, running this offense where he doesn't feel like he has to make every single play because the wide receivers feel like they're on the same page with the quarterback.
No question about that, Kevin. And I remember after the season opener against Duke, Notre Dame was just kind of okay. And we didn't really see much out of the receivers. And that was the big question mark, and the tight end too, going into the season, because they needed somebody to step up. And I think through the first month of the season, it was just still a major question mark. Like, okay, well who's going to step up? Who are the guys that are going to come through? And now we've started to see that over the last 6 weeks. And I was driving home from Jacksonville, the Florida-Georgia game, while the Notre Dame Clemson game was going on, listening to the radio, my hands gripped to the steering wheel as the end of that game unfolded. And when Ian Book fumbled, it appeared as if that was going to be it for Notre Dame. I was like, okay, that's it. Clemson's going to now take advantage and win this game. But the fact that he was able to come back and lead that drive at the end of the game and then get them the win in overtime, I don't think we have made a big enough deal about what that did for him, for the team, for their confidence, for those receivers. They have been a different team since that Clemson win. And I think that's all combined with everything they have going on the offense right now. They are playing with a confidence that they did not have in the early going of this season. And that's because you've seen the growth in not only the receivers and what's happening at the tight end position. They've got the best offensive line, if not one of the best offensive lines in the country. They've got a dazzling runner in Williams, as you mentioned, but now Ian Book has put it all together. We've seen these glimpses from him, and now he appears to be somebody who is completely immersed in knowing exactly what he has to do to be able to win games for Notre Dame. I just think this team right now is probably the best Notre Dame team we have seen since they played Alabama in the national championship game. We all knew what happened in that game, but mm-hmm. It feels as if they are better. I don't know. We'll see on Saturday, but because of that physicality and the way that they are playing up front and how they have developed on offense and some of those game changers they have on defense, basically on every level of the defense, I think Notre Dame is deserving of being a playoff team no matter what happens in this game. I think they've proved it throughout the course of the season and particularly this last month.
I'm with you. And it feels like the committee believes in the same thing. During a three-touchdown win by Clemson, it feels like regardless, Notre Dame, if they were to lose, will find themselves in the semifinal. And do you have a prediction? Do you like to give predictions? Don't want to put you on the spot. So before I even ask that, do you like to give predictions?
Yes, I am happy to give a prediction. My colleague, David Hale, and we make our ACC predictions. Nobody should listen to me because I have failed terribly with my predictions this year. I think he's got a 6-game lead on me. But I am picking Clemson. I think it's going to be a much closer game than people think. And of course, my 9-year-old confidently walked into my office the other day because she also makes predictions and her picks. And she puts her hands on her waist and says, well, I'm picking Notre Dame. They won the first time and I think they can do it again. And I'm like, girl, I love that spunk.
That is great. And Andrea, I want you to feel comfortable here in the podcast. Don't worry. Pollock has a 5-point lead on me when it comes to making picks. So listen, I feel you on that same thing, but we're all about the long-term comebacks and we will find a way. So Clemson, Notre Dame, can't wait for the matchup. Andrea, we do appreciate the time. Thank you.
All right, Kevin, always great to be on.
All right, we're mired into the college football playoff conversation, the conference championship games, and then you look at your watch and you're reminded that this is year four of the early signing period, and that is a big, big deal on Wednesday, December 16th, leading into Friday of this week. And it's great to have ESPN College Football National Recruiting Director Tom Luganville joining us, who wears many hats at the network, calling games and also making sure he's monitoring the best of the best in the industry and where they're going and what they're doing. And Lugs, we've kind of gotten used to, you know, early signing day and why it's so important. And it has replaced February and all the buildup in February that we've seen in the past. But this year is even more unique as we are in a pandemic. The dynamic of not being able to go on campus, as well as the other side, coaches not being able to go see players. What has been that experience like for people around the country?
It's been the most challenging recruiting cycle maybe in the history of college football. And thank goodness we are in the age of technology and Zoom and being able to virtually face-to-face with one another, because without it, I don't know how these coaches and players would have gathered any information. And you know, you touched on a couple of things. No official visits, no unofficial visits. A huge part of the recruitment of a player is to get that player on your campus, have him attend camp so you can evaluate him. How does he interact with other coaches and players, and how does he respond to hard coaching? All of these different things have been eliminated. So you're essentially looking at your graphics department, your internet department, and you're saying, guys, we got to put together an official visit virtually. And it's our only way of selling our program, because we're going to be signing players where we will shake their hand and we will see them in person for the first time when they arrive on our campus.
That's just wild. That is wild. And here's the thing, it's not one program going through it. It's everybody throughout the country, but this also can lead to the ability that certain programs have with coaches and the dynamic of recruiting a player face to face, especially if you're in a home and you're talking to the family involved, and that changes things. So when we talk about that and we set everything up, who's having a great day? Who will have a great week? Who's leading out the pack?
Well, I think the programs that have the greatest advantages are those that are your higher profile programs that even when this class, the 2021 class, were sophomores and juniors, they were in on those kids early. They had an opportunity to get them on campus, to see them, to talk to them, get them to camp. So they at least have a bit of a head start maybe on some of the programs that early on in the process maybe only had a handful of verbal commitments, let's just say last spring. So you've got your Clemsons, your Ohio States, your Alabamas, you know, your normal top-level programs all have a head start in that regard. But I would say that if in this cycle we're going to include Notre Dame as an ACC program, I think the ACC really gained a lot of ground. They could end up at the end of the day with four teams in the top 10 of the class rankings. And again, I go back, Miami, North Carolina, Notre Dame, Clemson, all of those programs were able to get in on these kids when they were really, really young. So they do know a little bit more than, let's just say, more of the middle tier to lower tier programs across the country. And I think that's going to pay huge dividends, because the earlier you can get on guys and get to know them, the better chance you have of creating that relationship, especially when it's face to face.
You mentioned the usual suspects. Jack Sawyer, number one recruit in the ESPN 300 defensive end, committed to Ohio State, the second best. Brockemeyer, Tommy's his first name, offensive tackle, going to Alabama. Yep. Then you got Alabama again in the top five with another offensive tackle from IMG. Miami's in there. Clemson, of course, got Jeremiah Trotter Jr., his dad, very famous linebacker. North Carolina in the mix. And this is Mac. This is Mac doing what Mac does. He builds on the defensive front, something that we've seen is a staple with Clemson. Anything else standing out when it comes to dynamic coaches? I'm leading you probably to this question, and that is Lane Kiffin, because we've seen a jump with Ole Miss recruiting.
Yeah, there's no question. I think there's two teams that would step up to me on this day that I think are going to have really good days by the end of the day. It's going to be the University of Maryland, who has made huge strides with Mike Locksley. And again, he arrived there when they were completing their football operations facility, their indoor facility. All of the pieces of the puzzle
were starting to come into place. And at the end of today, you're going to see, I think, an outstanding defensive front. To your point, that front seven being the key to competing in the Big Ten or any conference for that matter. And then for Ole Miss and for Lane Kiffin, I think we all acknowledge that offensively, they're an attractive destination. How could they not be? But Lane knows, as everybody else does, that one of the reasons why Ole Miss had been competitive at the height of their competitiveness was because of that Landshark defense. That's what's going to get them to close the gap with Alabama. So they went actually from yesterday to today, they were a top 50 class, went all the way up to number 20 because of the work of the last 48 hours. So it'll be interesting to see if they can close out strong on defense today.
How about two programs that there's a lot of doubt when it comes to stability and coaching? And that is Texas and Michigan. Where are they right now this week?
Well, just this morning, Michigan was, you know, a top 15 team coming into the day, had a commitment flip from Michigan to Maryland. I just mentioned Mike Locksley. So you're right. There's two things that prospects do not like: uncertainty and instability. So Michigan's facing that right now. And of course, you get negative recruiting tactics used against you when you are in the middle of discussing a contract extension. If you are Tom Herman at Texas, don't be surprised if not only do they not have much action today, but some of it being purposeful. I think that they're going to withhold some scholarships, get into the spring and the summer, and really, really search deep through the transfer portal. They need edge help on the defensive side. They need offensive line help. And they may feel like if the ideal guy is not interested in them right now because of the uncertainty, it's not in our best interest to go just throw a scholarship out there to a guy that we don't think can make a difference for. So let's wait and hold that back until the spring and summer. So I expect pretty much of a quiet day from Texas today.
Wow. And this is the reality that we're in. And I brought up the transfer portal. I think that it is, and just hearing your reaction, like it'll be critical for many programs on the rebound trying to find their way. I just look at, you know, me being a Temple grad, just DeJuan Mathis of Georgia transferring in the transfer portal to Temple. And so What kind of role does this transfer portal will play now and January and February as teams try to shore things up?
So Kevin, there are so many angles to that question that you just asked. I want to start off by saying that the discussion we had earlier about the challenges in recruiting and not getting to know these prospects and not being able to dial in and get all the ins and outs that you normally would could lead to some buyer's remorse, both on behalf of the programs and the players, in the sense that the next 12 to 15 months, I think, are going to be critical to see who made the right decisions, because we could have a massive flood into the transfer portal because kids either felt like they made a mistake or coaches felt like they made a mistake. And who could blame them? Mistakes are going to be made over the last 9 months. So that's big. Secondly, and this is the important thing, the extra year of eligibility that was provided by the NCAA, all right, the devil's always in the details with that. And the problem is the NCAA hasn't given any directive as to how they're supposed to manage the numbers. They're allowed to be over 85 for the first year, but then they got to get back down to 85 that second year and moving forward. So you're going to have to juggle the numbers of your incoming freshmen, potential outgoing transfers, incoming transfers, and then telling guys who've exhausted their scholarships that, yes, you still have an extra year of eligibility, but we're not going to be able to provide it for you here. I don't know if that's something you know of, Kevin, but the extra year of eligibility is afforded to everybody. But let's just say a player is at his current institution and he's at the end of his four-year scholarship and the school has held up their end of the bargain. He still gets his extra year, but that school is not required to give it to him. So there's going to be some tough discussions that are going to have to be made between player and coach, and there will be a trickle-down effect to the high school level, and there's really no direct blueprint on how to handle all this. So we are heading into muddy, uncharted waters over the next 2 years.
Wow. Okay. And again, next 2 years, we'll feel the effects into 2022. And we'll also feel the effects on a day like this and a week like this in 2022 when it comes to looking back and said, who has the best recruiting class of this week on Friday? Who do you think will say we have the number one class?
I think it's going to be Alabama with possibly Ohio State nipping at their heels that could overtake the number one spot. I don't think it's highly probable, but they're right there right now, so it wouldn't surprise me. But seeing what's happened so far on Wednesday, we've seen some flips already that have gone from other programs that have decided to sign with Alabama. They seem to be lengthening the gap.
The most stunning thing, too, when it comes to this, and I'm kind of a nerd when it comes to recruiting. You know, when we look at the draft is always highlighted by the quarterbacks, right? And we've seen mm-hmm. that the ability of running backs, you can find the talent a little bit later on. But it's always right. been quarterbacks, wide receivers. When you look at the top 10, the ESPN 300, not one quarterback, not one wide receiver. I am seeing in the trenches, defensive ends. Yep. And tackles, and you'll see a sprinkle of a linebacker, right? Is that normal? Mm-hmm. Is that normal from what we've seen in years past?
It absolutely is. And let's just look at the landscape of college football. What's the common denominator of all the dominant teams that have been in the college football playoff, won a playoff game, or won the national title? They're better than everybody else up front on both sides of the ball, and they all have a quarterback. So we place a lot of premium on O linemen, D linemen, defensive corners. Obviously, at the high school level, there can always be a lot to like about the quarterback, but there are so many unknown variables. You know, we see how many times the NFL misses on quarterbacks. Try doing it with a 17-year-old. Mm. And so there's a lot of risk there. So we usually try to temper that a little bit. But, you know, again, you look at Clemson, you look at Ohio State, you look at Alabama, you know, traditionally Georgia, Florida, LSU. Where are they dominant? And it's up front. And those are all the guys that the top teams are all jockeying for, and there's not enough of them.
Luke, for our audience, our final question. The one player you kind of have circled here that you're going to keep an eye on in this class that you just can't wait to see play.
Quarterback Jackson Dart. And this kid it's a great story, and it's a great reflection of what we've been through the last 9 months. This is a kid out of Zach Wilson's high school, Corner Canyon in Utah. All right. He came into his senior year, and, you know, he'd had a pretty decent career, but he really wasn't on the radar, not even at the Group of Five level. Had Utah, the state of Utah, not decided to play high school football, this kid's fortunes would be vastly changed. And because they did, and the season that he had as a senior, okay, he ended up climbing the charts higher than any other player we evaluated as a senior since August because of his performance as a senior. He needed that. And not every player was afforded that luxury. I think it's going to come down to Arizona State, BYU, or USC today. But he's an exciting player that had he not had his senior year, there's no telling what we'd be talking about.
Right now, 73rd in the ESPN 300. You can check out the entire list on ESPN.com. He's 6'3", 210 pounds, four-star recruit. And there's a gap right there that says list. So we will see how this plays out on his decision. Luke, you're the best, man. I appreciate you joining us here as we get ready for the rest of the week and, of course, signing day.
Always a pleasure. Go Owls.
Fingers crossed. Boy, we stuffed a lot there for you on this Wednesday. And big thanks to Andrea Adelson, Paul Feinbaum, Tom Luganville, and, of course, David Pollack here on the College Football Podcast. Plenty of topics that we've covered. Big shout-out to Taylor Schwenk, our producer, on the other side, coordinating the guests going in and out and our schedules and making sure it works for you as you get ready for a conference championship weekend. If you enjoyed the podcast, subscribe, rate, and review. We love hearing back from you. And it just makes us better each and every time as we continue to evolve and give you the best information and the best opinions when it comes to the sport that we all love. And if you want more college football, fingers crossed, yeah, enjoy the holidays, social distance, wear a mask, stay safe.